Are we up and running? All right. The proto-psychologists, that is not my word. I took that from Morton Hunt, who I've quoted several times. It's probably a good word. Proto, right? Prior to psychology, prior to the modern movement of secular soul care, you have these next four guys here. So last hour, we had just four names in front of us, right? Four names, though they couldn't be any different from the next four that we're going to talk about. So far today, we've had Luther, Bucer, Calvin, Knox. This hour, we have Hobbes, Descartes, Locke, and Kant. And while it's true that by 11 a.m. today, we will have studied both Calvin and Hobbes, I assure you that any live relationship between these guys is as fictional as the Gary Watterson comic strip of the same title. This Calvin and Hobbes would have had very little use for each other if they had ever met, which they did not meet because they separated from about by 25 years. They missed each other. Two very big ideas are in front of us this hour, the Renaissance and then the Enlightenment. And both movements are of shattering importance to the development of Western culture, or you might say to the regression of Western culture, I don't know, but and certainly the impact they have on soul care. So the first two names are related to the first of these movements, the Enlightenment. And so a word about what the Enlightenment was, don't want to assume that. I had to re-educate myself about the Enlightenment over the last couple of months, and so I'm about one day ahead of you on this, and you may not. I may not be ahead of you at all, so maybe behind you. So there's these two men that we'll talk about, Hobbes and Descartes, and then really there's just hundreds and hundreds of others that follow in their wake. These guys set out two treads that most people just walked in for about 100 years. So the Catholic theologian Erasmus, we haven't talked about, we won't talk, in 1517, said this about the Enlightenment. All over the world, as if on a given signal, splendid talents are stirring and conspiring together to revive the best learning. Okay, why? Why 500 years ago, almost to the year, right? 1517? Why 500 years ago was Erasmus able to say that? What was going on in Europe at the particular time? Yeah. Dr. David Larson, who used to be the pastor of First Cove downtown for 32 years in Minneapolis, gives us a little background. Larson says this. John Calvin called it Europae Concussio, the shattering of the Reformation. That's what Calvin called the Enlightenment. You're going to shatter the Reformation. What is that? Well, Larson says you have population surge, first of all. Babies being born everywhere. You have eschatological uneasiness. What is that? Just a sense of the end of days. This comes to us like waves on the shore. Then in the development of new classical learning, he says, painting turned from Gothic forms, music was written with broad appeal, interest in drama surged. European cultures absorbed all things Italian. Italy was really where the Enlightenment is born. And then he says the long medieval winter was over. The merchant class and commercial interests began to burgeon, and availability of and interest in all kinds of learning exploded, and exploration and colonization became a passion among governments. Now, to fill that out, that's Larson, who's a believer. I want to quote our friend Morton Hunt, our resident unbeliever, because he clarifies a number of specific developments that came to light during the Enlightenment. Listen to this. Hunt says this. What happened in the Enlightenment? Well, the introduction to Europe of gunpowder. It made castle walls and personal armor obsolete. It outmoded the feudal system. That's over when the Enlightenment happens. There's an increase in the number of scholars who were not clerics and not bound by doctrinal orthodoxy. That's huge. Non-clergy scholars that don't feel beholden to doctrinal statements. were churches. The inventing of the printing press around 1440 made it possible for study outside of church-dominated universities. The church dominated all the universities. Once the printing press is happening, you don't have to go to those universities to get the only books that are available. You can begin other sorts of schools. And then you have all of these folks. Hunt says, Vesalius corrected many of Galen's anatomical errors, so human anatomy is beginning to be understood a little better. Copernicus proved that the sun was at the center of the solar system. Well, that's a gain. Galileo discovered that there were mountains on the moon and that the Milky Way is made up of individual stars. Harvey discovered the circulation of blood. Well, that's a win. Agricola made important contributions to mineralogy, Perret to surgery, Mercator to map making, Tycho and Kepler to astronomy, and Columbus and Magellan to geography. Okay, so each of these are pretty startling discoveries. To think that they all came about inside of about 200 years is very impressive. Now that's the upside to the Renaissance. Sorry, the Enlightenment, right? No, the Renaissance, excuse me. I'm mixing my terms here. Renaissance came first. Those are the gains. Now, are there any losses? Yes. What were they? I can sum up the losses with the rhetorical question that Jesus asks in Matthew 16:26. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world but loses his soul? Imagine Jesus saying that, but put that over our seminar, this hour of our seminar. What Jesus asks of a single man, we could ask of the entire project here, right? What does it profit a people if they gain books, medicine, astronomy, geology, cartography, and geography? What does it profit us if we gain the whole world, yet forfeit our very souls? Is that a good trade? Now, as Guy mentioned last night, it doesn't have to be a trade. You don't have to trade these up. Christians like books. Christians like surgery and cartography and geology. Christians are interested in space exploration and sciences. Christians ought to be and can be about these things. But we don't have to trade these things. We can redeem these things. So let's take a look at two Renaissance men, Hobbes and Descartes. First, Hobbes. Hobbes was a Brit born in 1588. It's almost a quarter century after the death of Calvin. So Calvin and Hobbes were not contemporaries. Okay, I'll stop now. I'll say it one more time. Thomas Hobbes was, for all intents and purposes, a psychologist. Maybe not in the modern sense, but in the classical sense. He was somebody who pursued soul wisdom. He was a philosopher with a very keen interest in politics. He was also a PK, a pastor's kid. And it may be owing in part to his father's vocation. I think about this with pastor's kids, but Hobbes claimed that anxiety plagued him his whole life. He said at one point, "Myself and fear were born twins." I feel that way, and my dad was a packaging salesman for 40 years. I'm just the most frightened person I've ever met in my life. And Hobbes felt that way too, anxiety. That happens with pastor's kids, I think. Doesn't have to, but it can. So Hobbes made waves with a book that he published in 1651. 1651, we need to get our bearings here. 1649, the King of England's head was cut off. Okay, Charles the First, 1649. Hobbes thought that that was a mistake because he believed that people need a king. And you know what? He's right. People do need a king, much to the chagrin of democratic governments. We're not vying for a king. I'm just saying we need a king, capital K, king over us. So this period of time in Great Britain was known as the interregnum, the time between the kings. It was also called the Commonwealth. It was an 11-year period where the Parliament led the government of England without the rule of a king. So Charles I is executed in 1649, And then his son Charles II ascended the throne in 1660. So there's no king. And Hobbes doesn't like it. He thought people needed a king. Why? Because Hobbes understood the essential depravity of the human heart. I'm not sure that he understood or appreciated the way of redemption. I don't think he did. But he did understand the way of depravity. It was his studied opinion that apart from what he called the dread of sovereign royalty over us, life will be, his words, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Okay. If you ever heard that string of five adjectives together, you learned it from Hobbes. He was not optimistic about human nature at all. And in 1651, he wrote a book called Leviathan. He used the imagery of a terrifying ancient sea creature coming up from the depths to represent government. Government ought to strike fear. In fact, the Bible says that. And so you might imagine that the book was not well received during the period of the Commonwealth. It was not well received. He was accused of atheism, blasphemy, profanity. It was even suggested that Hobbes be burned alive. He was granted reprieve, interestingly. I'm not exactly sure why. He was slapped on the wrist and told not to write such incendiary things. And just retire to your study. Stop writing things like that or you're going to get in trouble. He retired to his study, but he didn't stop writing. Essentially, Hobbes' most successful achievement wasn't in the realm of politics, probably, but in philosophy, which would lay the groundwork for much of modern psychology. His 1658 book, Human Nature, moves along these lines. He spoke in rather muted tones. He had to, given the religious climate of the time. But his greatest coup, if you can call it that, was splitting theology from philosophy. So remember, what were we talking about last night? Where are we? Yeah, there we go. Aquinas wants theology and philosophy, theology and psychology to be together. By the time you get to Hobbes, he wants them torn apart. And that happened on his watch. But he had to work carefully. And essentially what his books did was make perforations between the two. And it was the work of succeeding generations just to tear that garment apart. But he made it possible for people to think about psychology in purely secular categories. So what Hobbes began, others would continue and eventually separate completely. David Larson explains, Hobbes greatly resented all clergy, and he thought the Puritans were anathema. Okay, that breaks my heart, because I am a Puritan. I want to be a Puritan so bad. Hobbes, Larson says, did not care for sermons and opposed Bible translation. He saw only some moral value in Scripture. He seems to use the language of theism. He uses God talk. It's expedient at the time. But he says we can know nothing of God other than that he is omnipotent. He's all-powerful. Hobbes's views of the Bible, Larson says, are precursory to higher critical notions. So Hobbes gave higher critical theorists, those who stood in judgment of the Bible in the succeeding generations, the tools they needed to do that. And Larson finishes by saying, rationalism is on the rampage. Okay. So Hobbes wasn't alone, though, during this time. Over in France, there's another Renaissance man named René Descartes. Descartes is really important, more important than Hobbes probably for the development of secular psychology. Historian Robert Watson called Descartes the first great psychologist of the modern age. He is a fascinating man, Descartes. When he was a teenager, he spent time in the Parisian nightlife, like gambling halls and such, and he was unimpressed. He was bored by what was going on there. The debauchery just was unimpressive to him. And so he turned his attention to the world of ideas. It happened to be that Descartes was a math genius, also had a great interest in philosophy. In fact, in the realm of philosophy is where we really begin to see him make his impact. Story is told that one night he's in his room warming himself by his furnace, his fire, and stove, and he had what he believed to be an epiphany. And the epiphany is this: I will just doubt everything I can. That's what he starts with. By everything, he meant everything, unless it could be demonstrated by reason that he ought to believe in its existence. So you can imagine how this would go down with the church of his time. Descartes, editing himself within his own works, he says this. He gets pretty deep into one of his philosophical discussions where he's just destroying the role of theology. And then he says this: recalling my insignificance, I affirm nothing and submit all these opinions to the authority of the Catholic Church and the judgment of the more sage. Okay, that's what he says early on. That's not going to last long. He kept doubting. For him, it seemed like the right course. And here's how he said it. I believe you hear something familiar here. I think I just whispered it. But here's what Descartes says: I thought I ought to reject as absolutely false all opinions in regard to which I could imagine there to be the least ground for doubt, so as to ascertain whether so after doing there remained anything in my belief that was wholly indubitable. But immediately I noticed that even while I thus wished to think that all things were false, it was absolutely necessary that I, who thought this, was something. Okay? I'm something, and so I observe this truth. Cognito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. He says, that is so certain and so evident. There's no ground for doubt, however extravagant, brought forth by skeptics, could shake this. So I concluded, without scruple, to accept it as the first principle of the philosophy I was seeking. Now, I don't know how that sounds to you, but that may sound obvious, but what he's doing here is incredibly dangerous. He is making the self the foundation and center of all existence, which I know goes down well in 21st century America. But we are frogs in a pot here. This is a very dangerous way of thinking, making self the foundation and center of all existence, and then even doubting the ability to know anything further about existence. This is frightening. And this is how the Renaissance took a Godward universe and bent it manward, and we've been there ever since. And I'll tell you, here's an example. John Piper said one time, this isn't in the manuscript, but he said to a group of... he was speaking to the media, like Kohl's Media in Twin Cities 20 years ago, and he said, he pulled out a Star Tribune, and he said, you read through this whole thing, and there's nothing about God. And they're all like, he says, there's a whole section called sports. Not one column for God. And then he's like, well, what do you want to do, Piper? You want to turn the Star Tribune into a religion journal? Is that what you want to do? He said, it's not religion. It's reality. When you don't deal with God, you are superficial in the way that you are approaching life. And so everything we do is superficial. Everything is superficial. TV is superficial. Newspaper is superficial. Internet, by and large, is superficial. We are talking about everything except the main reality in life, which is God. Well, who do we have to thank for that? Descartes is a good place to begin where that project started, okay? Although, certainly, since did God really say in the... But this is where whole peoples begin to think this way, as Descartes. Doubt everything except yourself. I'm here, so let's build the world around me. Okay. His great work, if you can call it that, was called Discourse on Method. His assumptions are the assumptions of modern psychology. You can see traces in Descartes simply everywhere in the last 100 years, from Freud's depth psychology to Skinner's behaviorism to Rogers' client-centered therapy to the continuing popularity of CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy today. Descartes is truly the first psychologist of the modern man-centered age. So now we need to hit the fast-forward button about 100 years, because we're going to visit two men that emerged onto the scene during the Enlightenment. But to do that, we need to discuss the Enlightenment itself. So let's go back to our two kind of dueling historians here, Larson the Christian and Hunt the non-Christian. And what we're going to see is they're telling the same story, which is really helpful. When you have two guys with totally different worldviews that tell the history the same way, you know you're probably heading down the right path. So Larson made a fascinating observation about the forces that were vying for supremacy during the 16th and 17th centuries. Here's what he says. Medieval culture was challenged by Renaissance humanism on the one hand and by the powerful tidal waves of the Protestant Reformation on the other. This is really interesting. Renaissance humanism, so the rebirth of man-centeredness, and then the Protestant Reformation, which was a very vertical, Bible-centered, Jesus-rooted way of thinking, God-centered life. And that's pressing on culture. Both of those things are happening. Which is going to win? Well, beginning by the 18th century, there's no question which one won. The Renaissance won. And the Renaissance won because of the triumph of the Enlightenment. What was the Enlightenment? Larson explains. The Enlightenment stood for autonomy, nature, progress. It was anti-clerical, anti-clergy, anti-pastor, and opposed to religion generally. It was a triumph of rationalism. And if there were ever two men who perfectly exemplified the philosophy of rationalism, they were John Locke and Immanuel Kant. Take each in turn. Here's John Locke. John Locke is an interesting man because he's born into a Puritan home. 1632. Way to think about the Puritans, the great Puritan century, 1560 to 1660. Okay, that's the great century of the Puritans. And Locke is born smack in the middle of that. His father was an attorney, and though he was born to privilege, he also grew up learning from the inside out what it was like to be a part of a despised minority. The Puritans were doing incredible work. They just weren't the dominant group in the culture. And when they got a hold of the domination of the culture, it lasted about 11 years, and then everything fell apart, and 2,000 Puritans were cast out of their churches in 1662. We'll talk about that next hour. Locke's dad is an attorney, a committed Puritan, and Locke is watching his dad suffer. And he's thinking, yeah, there's got to be another way here. Locke went to Oxford University, which is interesting because that's where my hero, John Owen, went, and they would have spent time together. They crossed over there at Oxford. Locke and Owen were there at the same time. One of these guys went on to become the Prince of the Puritans. That's what they call John Owen, the Prince of the Puritans. And the other went on to oppose nearly everything they stood for. So how do you account for that? I wonder about that. Both guys grew up in the homes of Puritan parents. And one understood the cost of discipleship and began to follow Jesus. And the other one looked at the cost of discipleship, understood it, and did not follow Jesus. So what's the difference between John Locke and John Owen? This sounds like a joke. But what's the difference between John Locke and John Owen? When it comes right down to it, it's one thing. Grace. Grace is the only difference. 1 Corinthians 4:7 says, "For who sees anything different in you? What do you have that you did not receive? And if you received it, why do you boast as if you did not receive it?" Right? It's grace that makes John Owen to differ from John Locke. And it's grace that makes any of us to differ. So John Locke grows up smack in the middle of Puritan England, and he really came to resent these guys. His heart reacted very strongly to his upbringing, is another way to say it. And he, instead of joining the Puritan cause, didn't become a theologian or a pastor. He became a scholar and a politician and a piercing critic of Christ and the church. Of course, in muted tones, because he's living in Puritan England, after all. The work that made him famous was his Essay Concerning Human Understanding. You can imagine why he might be relevant to the discussion of soul care. Okay. His Essay Concerning Human Understanding. It was published in 1690. And the essay was notorious for coming against what he called the doctrine of innate ideas. What's that? The doctrine of innate ideas would include such things as the law of God, written on the human hearts of man, Romans 2. It would also include the doctrine of original sin. Here's how Locke put it, Locke's words. He says, "Let us then suppose the mind at birth to be, as we say, white paper." White paper. Void of characters, without any ideas. How comes that piece of paper to be furnished? I answer in one word, experience. In that all our knowledge is founded, and from that experience it ultimately derives itself. Now, he's often been credited with developing the idea of the tabula rasa, the mind or the human being as a blank slate at birth. But interestingly, it's not original with Locke. It's at least as old as Aquinas, and it probably is as old as Aristotle. Aristotle was talking that way. Human beings are blank slates when they're born. So Aristotle was the original doubter of the doctrine of innate ideas. Actually, serpent in the Garden of Eden, right? Did God actually say, right? But Aristotle did it too. And so Locke gives it a push, though, through this sort of philosophy, this sort of psychology. Locke's ideas, though not new, were popular, and they had currency. He believed just enough orthodoxy about Christ to get these ideas out into the culture, into a very religious culture. He was a heretic, though never charged with heresy. He believed in the miracles of Jesus, but not in Jesus' divinity. He believed that Jesus is the Messiah, but not a substitutionary sacrifice on the cross. He used Scripture. He knew the Bible, but he used it very carefully and very critically. He's biblical to a point, but when it comes right down to it, he's not Christian. David Larson concludes that for Locke, Christ came to reform, but not to redeem. Salvation is by works entirely, by obeying the moral law. So Locke was kind of a harbinger of the world of secular psychology it was to come. So one more figure, and we'll have some discussion. Let's talk about Immanuel Kant. Kant is another one of these towering figures, though it's interesting. His pattern of life was rather ordinary. Historians say that you could practically set your watch by this man's lifestyle. Kant was an ivory tower scholar. If anybody was, Immanuel Kant was. He was born and raised and lived and died in Prussia, which is modern-day Germany mainly. He woke up every day at 5 a.m. He wrote and studied and lectured alternately all day long, until 10 p.m. when he went to bed. He took a break at 3:30 p.m. every day for his daily constitutional. He took a walk. No matter what the weather was, he spoke to no one, and then he went back to work, back to the study, back to the classroom. I mentioned retired at 10 p.m. every night. Kant never traveled more than 40 miles from home. That's interesting. He says, why are we studying this guy? Well, because if you were to name, yeah, the top five influential philosophers in the history of planet Earth, he is in the top five in terms of secular philosophers. You got Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. You might throw in John Stuart Mill, who we're not going to study, and then Kant. He's that big. If you take a philosophy 101 class at any university in this country today, you have to deal with Kant. You have to. He's that important. And he taught on everything. He was an ethicist, a theologian, a logician. His big work was called The Critique of Pure Reason. He published that in 1781. So think through that a little bit. That's 5 years after the founding of our nation. Kant said of the book, The Critique of Pure Reason, listen to this. I venture to assert there's not a single metaphysical problem that hasn't been solved here, or a solution of which the key has not been at least supplied. Well, at least we know what he thought of his work. What did others think of it? One story goes that as soon as he'd finished his work and handing it to his friend Lampe, who briefed it, he told Kant this. He said, "You have taken my God away." That's what he told Kant. Well, there's a blurb for your book. You've taken my God away. What did he teach? Well, his most famous idea, maybe, was what he called the categorical imperative. The categorical imperative is simply this: to act only in a way that if what you were to do, everyone does. It becomes a universal law. So in other words, yeah, go ahead, do your thing. Just everyone else on the planet is acting like you too. How's that go for us? Does this sound familiar? Yeah, it's a way of coming at, it is. It's a way of coming at Matthew 7:12. The golden rule: do unto others as you would have them do unto you. We don't need Kant for that. That was his most important idea, and Jesus beat him to the punch 1,700 years prior. And Jesus just said, "Look, I'm just summing up the Law and the Prophets, by the way. Like, if you want to just whittle down the Old Testament, just do for others what you want them to do for you. That's the whole Bible. We don't need Kant for that." And you don't want Kant's behavior to be a categorical imperative. Trust me. David Larson tells us this. In daily life, Kant never prayed, nor did he attend church. He did not believe it necessary for a Christian to affirm faith in miracles or the divinity of Christ or the atonement by Christ's crucifixion for the sins of mankind, heaven or hell. Okay, so can you counsel this? Oh, yeah, you can counsel Kant. People do. Is it safe? No, it's not. He's a very dangerous soul care physician, and his ideas have laid the bedrock for literally hundreds and hundreds of godless psychologies that are on the market today. 19th century poet Heinrich Heine said of Kant that he beheaded belief in God. Kant beheaded belief in God. Will Durant said that Kant's work represents, quote, one of the most destructive analyses of Christian theology ever received, end quote. One of the most destructive analyses of Christian theology ever received. Okay, so over the last hour, we've seen in the Renaissance and the Enlightenment that really big shifts are occurring in the Western culture. These shifts are represented in Hodge and Descartes and Locke and Kant. So what's going on? And how does this happen right on the heels of the Reformation in the midst of the great Puritan century that's coming? Well, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. So let me paint a picture at the end of this first talk that'll help us to think through. This is really important, actually, to what's going on. And I want to encourage you to doodle if you have a pen. Picture a four-sided figure. In the world of geometry, it's a quadrilateral. And if it helps you to draw one on your notes, just draw it. But if you're going to, take your square or your rectangle or whatever and begin with it at 90 degrees in your mind, but then just tilt it to 45 degrees. So make a diamond shape. Make like a baseball diamond. You want your quadrilateral to be pointed at top and bottom, looking like a diamond. Now let's do some labeling. On the left side of your diamond, write the word reason. Reason. At the bottom of your diamond, write the word experience. Experience. On the right side of your diamond, write the word tradition. tradition. So you have reason, experience, tradition. Now, there's one more that you want to write in order to complete the picture, and it's the word scripture. That's the top point. So it's a quadrilateral, four-sided, diamond-looking figure. Four sides, 4 points. Moving in counterclockwise fashion, at 9 o'clock, you've got reason. 6 o'clock, you've got experience. 3 o'clock, tradition. 12 o'clock, 12 noon, is scripture. Okay, there's the art lesson. Now on to the historical theology lesson. Last century, there was a Methodist scholar by the name of Albert Outler. And Outler, being a Methodist, was interested in the life and thought of John Wesley. And as Outler thought about Wesley, he noticed that time and time again, there was a pattern. Like Descartes, Wesley was interested in the appropriate exercise of human reason. Wesley prized the life of the mind, and Wesley was an exceptional scholar. Now, at the same time, Wesley, like Kant, would have flown the banner for human experience. Not just for entertaining truths, but for entering into them. Experience was a very big deal for John Wesley. And then, too, Wesley, like all of us, was a man that played for a particular team. In fact, he played for two of them, the Anglicans and the Methodists. So Wesley also prized the broader Christian tradition. He wasn't interested in creating something new, but rather preserving something very, very old. Wesley had a very high regard for tradition, as did Locke. Locke leaned on Aquinas and Aristotle. But Wesley had something that neither Hobbes, nor Descartes, nor Locke, nor Kant had, which was an authoritative Bible. Wesley clearly believed that human reason, human experience, and human tradition were legitimate sources of authority for our lives. But it was the Bible for Wesley, the Bible and the Bible alone, that provided the ultimate authority for his life. So Wesley would say, give reason and tradition and experience their due, but the buck stops with the Bible. Wesley famously wrote, God himself has condescended to teach me the way. For this very end he came from heaven. He hath written it down in a book. Oh, give me that book. At any price, give me the book of God. So it's hard to know where Wesley stood on some issues. It's just not hard to know where he stood with reference to the Bible. Wesley was actually called a Bible bigot in his day. A Bible bigot. You can call me that anytime. I am partial. Guilty as charged. Let's have a bias, and let's have a bias toward the Bible. I hope that describes you too. The Renaissance and Enlightenment were many things, and they were many good things, but they came with a price tag. The picture that you drew, the quadrilateral, got tilted. And in the world of secular soul care, it's just never recovered. The culture has abandoned biblical authority. And what's tragic is when the church begins to take her cues from the culture on this matter, and the tail begins to wag the dog. And that's happening today. But that's another seminar. That would be in the fall when we do part 3. So we've got 1 hour left. And you have my word, it will be encouraging because we're going to study the 17th century Puritans. But let's pause again for a little bit of a break, and then questions, thoughts, comments, concerns, and so on.